Alright, would you state your name and your rank that you ended in the military with?
My name is Joe Laster. My last recorded rank was Major. I was discharged in 1977.
Okay. Age of entry into the U.S. military?
Entered the military when I was 19.
Okay. And it says you're from, where?
I enlisted in Aurora, Colorado.
Aurora, Colorado.
April 1964.
Okay. So how was your basic training experience initially?
Basic training in the Army, just kind of basic training. They wake you up, take you out, make you do physical training or drilling ceremonies, then you go back to bed.
Okay.
That's just kind of a normal routine. It hasn't changed any for a number of years that I'm aware of.
What were the distinct differences between advanced technical training and your basic training, positive or negative?
There's a difference in the discipline factor. When you go into your advanced individual training, they relax whatever restrictions they have on you. When I was in basic training, everybody was restricted to base and remained there for the entire 8-week tour. Once I started advanced training in Fort Gordon, Georgia, in a military police environment, everybody had weekend passes, and you basically worked a 5-day work week. Fort Gordon, Georgia is where the military police do their advanced training.
So you were initially an MP then?
Yes. And after that I went to jump school.
What made you decide to go to jump school?
I enlisted to go to jump school. That was my enlistment option, just to go to paratrooper school.
Was there any mishaps or anything that you remember from jump school in particular?
No. Not that I know of. There wasn't any major injuries or anything like that.
In your armor OCS training, did y'all emphasize in jungle warfare at all, or was it mostly just conventional tactics?
I did conventional tactics. When the final phases of it, the last month and a half or 2 months, was basically Vietnam oriented.
Okay. What were your experiences at Jungle Survival School? What would be a normal day, kind of little outline?
Well, Jungle Survival School, they spend the first week teaching you how to survive, and the second week they run you through continuing exercises, and you stay in the jungle the entire time.
So when you said you stay in the jungle, you mean they literally dump you in the jungle and you have to survive?
They bust you out into the jungle and keep you out there, and that's where you take all your training and all your classes, and you get all your meals out there.
What jungle? Where
we were in Panama. I don't remember the name of the place. I think Fort Sherman, it's down on the canal zone.
Were there any foreign officers that were training y'all?
No.
All U.S.
They were all U.S. cadre that was down there in that area.
Okay.
And the third week of it was all survival training. They ran you on constant day and night operations and survival training.
How did you feel the quality of the instructions you were given were?
The stuff in jungle school was basically survival oriented. It was how to survive out in the jungle, what you could eat, what you couldn't eat, and how to do patrols. Night patrols, and that was good training. The training in OCS was...
You said miserable right here.
Hmm?
You said miserable.
Well, it was, OCS is just pretty much misery training. It's just, how miserable can they make you and keep you functioning so you can function through combat or any number of other stressful situations. It's a high stress environment. It's not any fun.
So you felt your training prepared you pretty well for what you're getting into?
As much as any training can prepare you for that.
I understand. What kind of equipment were you first issued with when you went in country? Do you have an M16 or?
I was issued an M16 rifle and a .45 automatic when I was in country.
Did you have any problems with that rifle?
Not unless you got into the dry season and in a real dirty, dusty environment, that it was a problem. But cleaning took care of it.
So nothing that normal maintenance wouldn't take care of.
No.
So most of the cases when people report jams and stuff is because they neglected to clean their weapons. Would you say that?
I would say that I was in a cavalry unit and I had plenty of opportunities to clean weapons because we were riding around in tracks. And the weapons, it's cranky because of the tolerances of it. I mean, and that's a known fact, and it's been improved over the years. The particular weapon I had, I didn't have any particular problems with it, with jamming or anything like that. But I didn't use it a lot either. Most of the time we were using machine guns, M60 and M2 machine guns off the tracks.
And when you say tracks, you mean APCs, right?
113A1s. APCs.
Weren't those the ones that could go in and float too?
Yeah, they would float, but it wasn't advisable.
All right.
If all your seals were good, that was fine. We never drove them out in the water. There was no reason to. The platoon I was assigned to had 3 M48 tanks assigned to it, and it had 7 personnel carriers assigned to it. One of them, which was a mortar track, with a 4-deuce mortar on it.
Okay. Alright, So you volunteered to go to Vietnam, right?
Yes.
Did you have any particular feelings about going there before you went? Negative or positive?
I was mostly positive. I joined the Army so I could go.
Kind of ready to get out there. And
I was ready to go out and see what I could do and see what would happen.
Okay. Just for the record, could you run through, you can read this if you need to, the list of units that you had been assigned, you were assigned in over Vietnam?
My first tour, I was assigned to C Troop, 1st Squadron, 4th Cavalry of the 1st Infantry Division. We did ground reconnaissance, almost specifically.
That would entail exactly what?
Ground reconnaissance. You just give them an area of operation, a grid, a spot on the map, and you go out and drive through it or break through the jungle.
And this was on foot?
No, you did it on the tracks. Usually used an M48 tank to crash through the jungle or bust the brush, as we called it, and the rest of the platoon would follow up behind them and go into suspected base camps. Normally were picked up by the Mohawks on infrared surveillance, hotspots.
Mohawks are what?
Mohawks, twin-engine reconnaissance aircraft used by the Army. We basically responded to intelligence analysis by division headquarters because we were attached directly to the division headquarters.
Okay.
Which is where your CAF squadrons actually operate from, through the divisional reconnaissance units.
And that was in your first tour?
It was on my first tour.
And your second tour?
My second tour, I was attached to an independent brigade out of Quad Tree, which is the Northern I Corps up along the DMZ.
Can I spell that?
What?
Quantri.
Quantri.
All And then, so you served three tours then?
Two.
Two, and then one in the helicopter?
Well, that was the second tour in Quantrees when I was in helicopters.
Okay. So you didn't. So you weren't on the ground very much during the second tour?
No, I flew on this almost exclusively on my second tour.
All right. So obviously, as you said, you have no idea what battles you were participated in, or anything like that, or dates.
No, I don't.
Okay, I'm just.
I don't have that information anymore. Yeah. It was destroyed at an opportune moment.
It was destroyed in an accident. We'll leave it at that. What was, like, generally, when, I guess during your first tour, when y'all would do combat patrol, right? What weapons were y'all generally issued, like the weapon distribution? Like,
well, our standard issue in an armored cav platoon at the time was, as I said before, three tanks and seven personnel carriers.
Okay.
There were about 30 men in the platoon, depending on how the strength was adjusted through either attrition or people leaving, coming back. There were three crew members on the tanks, and there was usually three or four crew members on each track, depending on how many people we had. Normal patrol operations, we normally stayed out in the jungle. We would set up a defensive perimeter position at night. We would stay there, set out listening posts, observation posts, and we'd basically just spend the night there. We'd run ambush patrols in some areas if there was any activity projected in the area. And then at first light, you'd roll back up and go back out on patrol and either go back looking at different areas that intel thought there was something there. The troop commander had decided where they were going. We normally didn't operate. We operated off of verbal orders. We didn't operate off of written orders at any time that I know of.
Okay.
And most of your major operations were developed at divisional and brigade headquarters. And that information wasn't necessarily passed down to us at platoon level.
For reasons of being captured?
Well, they didn't. If you were captured or whatever, you went in and were briefed at the troop headquarters, and you were sent out to your area of operation. And if there were three platoons there in that troop, depending on how you were configured, and sometimes you were out pulling security for the infantry, and there'd been an infantry company out there doing ground operations, and you were there in support of them. One, so they could sleep at night, and two, you provided heavy firepower for them if they became engaged in a firefight.
If you remember, if you don't, it's fine. Did you know when you first engaged the enemy in combat?
The second day I was there.
Second day? Do you know what circumstance? Do you remember what circumstances?
We were on patrol, and we were sent out on first light, and within about 15 or 20 minutes, we were three guys that shot an RPG at us and fired a few rounds at us.
Were there any casualties?
Not on our side. There was on their side. But they missed with the RPG. They were shooting RPGs at the time, which were fairly inaccurate. They were pretty much 100-yard weapons until they started running into the RPG-7s with the optical sights on
them. Okay. What kind of enemy were they? Were they Viet Cong?
They were Viet Cong.
Viet Cong.
They were. Until the Tet Offensive started, there were not a whole lot of NVA working in that area that we came in contact with.
All in all, like, how would you really assess the enemy's ability to wage war?
Well, they did quite well. They ran us off over a period of time, but that was more lack of backbone on part of the politicians than it was the military being able to resolve that war at any particular time.
And generally, when y'all make when y'all ran into contact, did y'all instigate it, or did they instigate it generally?
They normally instigated it against the cavalry units as a defensive measure on their part, because we were actually being the aggressor movement through their area. Seldom did they attack
in force.
I don't know that they ever tried to attack my cav platoon in force. Anytime that we engaged them, we were actually actively seeking them out.
So you're hunting them down.
Yeah, we were pretty much active in them.
So you are pretty much doing this search.
That depended on who was running the cav troop and who was running the platoons, how active and how aggressive you were being.
When y'all went in, how many day periods would y'all go into the jungle and at a time?
We normally stayed in the jungle unless we were back on a quarterly maintenance or something like that. We stayed out of the base camp probably 20-25 days at a time.
Okay.
We passed through other base camps for resupply, for ammunition and sea rations and stuff like that, but we were just passing through. You might spend one night there, but you moved right on back out in the jungle in support of another operation all the time.
Alright, how did your equipment hold up in the jungle? Was the jungle environment particularly hard on it, or do you remember any particular very bad maintenance problems that the jungle caused?
Well, we were using the tanks, though, to actually knock trees and bust brush and knock the jungle down, and it tore up the fenders and the sponson boxes, and it tore the lights off of them. And the M48 tank had an oil field hub on it, and it would break the hubs on it.
Oil field hub, what do you mean?
The road wheels on the tank have a hubcap on it that had oil in it, and that's what actually lubricated the road wheel. And if you broke it,
the road wheel, the two ones on the end.
There were five road wheels on it that run on the bottom of the track.
Okay.
And the end wheels, you've got an eider pulley, and you've got a sprocket on it. The sprocket's in the back, and there's a big eider wheel up front that actually just is a track follower. But the road wheels actually are the ones that sit on the ground, and they were hooked up to torsion bars, which twisted and torqued all the time. And if that hub froze up, then it'd break that torsion bar. And you'd have to pull the engine out of it if it was one of the rear ones, because the torsion bar went actually underneath the engine into the other side into a socket on the other side.
So it was almost maybe a little bit of a design flaw.
Well, it was, as long as it didn't break, it was okay.
So you are almost using the tanks more as bulldozers.
Yeah, they were using them as bulldozers, and they finally started bringing bulldozers out there to do that, but the bulldozer operators didn't want to lead the way into the jungle.
It's understandable.
Which was understandable on their part.
Yes, it was. What kind of tanks were those again?
M48A3s.
And they had, what kind of cannon did they have on them?
90mm.
Was that the one that had the short barrel so you could traverse the jungle, or?
No, it had a standard length barrel on it with a T-shaped muzzle brake.
Did y'all run into any problems with the trees?
every once in a while, if the tank commander wasn't watching what he was doing, and if you hit a tree with it, it unloaded a gun for you.
You mean the gun go off?
Well, no, it just unloaded. It kicked the shell out of them.
Oh, okay.
It knocked it out of battery, and the shell would drop out on the floor.
Okay. Break up a couple of foot that way.
Well, the loader didn't stay down inside of it. The loader usually stayed up on top. They were too hot inside. Temperature inside of it.
I could imagine.
150 degrees out there in the sun. You didn't stay inside of it.
Okay. How would you describe the morale of, you had men under your command, right?
Yeah, I had 30 men under my command.
In general, how would you describe the morale of them from when you, like, when y'all went in country, did y'all go in as a platoon?
No, they were already there when I went in.
They were already there, so you showed up new to them.
Yep.
How did they treat you when you first got there? Or how did they
perceive
you?
Oh, they treated me fine. They didn't perceive me as anything other than a new lieutenant coming in.
How long did it take you to get there? I guess, quote-unquote, respect type thing.
About 5 minutes. That weren't disrespectful or anything like that. I was just a new guy coming into country.
FNG.
And the guy that left just left. When I showed up, he got in the Jeep that I got out of and left.
He didn't tell you anything?
He didn't tell me anything. He said, see that tank over there? And he said, that one's yours. And he said, that tank over there? And he said, that was yours and everything in between is yours. Company commander's over there underneath that tent. And that was the end of it. He got in the Jeep and left.
So y'all basically had a one or two sentence conversation.
Yeah. Hi, thanks for relieving me. Goodbye.
Okay.
I'm out of here.
Okay. Back to the morale. How did the troops? Was it high, low, up and down?
Morale was good.
Mm-hmm.
That particular unit had just been in some major battles about a month before that, and all the armored personnel had been replaced with infantry personnel. And they had absolutely no experience on the tracks.
Did that pose problems?
It posed problems. It was a maintenance problem.
Because they didn't know how to take care of them?
And my first month in country was basically teaching maintenance classes to infantry people so they would actually become track people.
And maintenance would include greasing, grease starts?
Normal. All tracks require an extensive amount of maintenance. You have before operational maintenance, just oil checks and wheel checks and stuff like that. And then when you're running a track, after every 2 to 5 hours, you stop it and get out and walk around it and check it and make
big
trees and bearings and stuff out of, you know, places out of the track. And look for things that are leaking, and if you can fix it, you fix it. And when you get back in the evening, you do the same thing. You get out, you know, get your shovels and your tanker bars out, and you break all the mud and crud out of your tracks that wedge up between the hull of the vehicle and the sprockets as it pushes the track off of it.
If you neglected it, it would eventually push
throw the track. And the track just rolls off of it, and you have to stop and spend anywhere from an hour to 5 hours putting the track back on, depending on if you're in the mud or if you're on hard ground or you're in tree stumps or what kind of terrain you're sitting on. Sometimes you have to drag the tank a half a mile before you can get it on a level ground to get the track back on it. And we did that with the APCs. And you just hook onto the track and drag it with you.
The APCs, you drag them? They were tracks too?
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever run it into any distinctively like Viet Cong and Pavan troops? Did you notice any differences between the two?
Well, we didn't. You know, we call them Viet Cong or NVA, the North Vietnamese Army. The North Vietnamese were mostly draftees. And they weren't hardcore guerrilla fighters. I mean, they were pretty much soldiers. They would do whatever they were told to do.
And they just there because they're
mainly because they got shot if they didn't. I mean, that seemed to be their primary motivation. At least that's what we were given to understand.
So it wouldn't be completely unlikely that there'd be an officer behind them with a pistol.
Officer, sergeants, the non-coms. That isn't anything you see, though. I mean,
yeah.
I've seen them when I was flying, but most of the people that you ran into up in I Corps, they were just basically transport troops. They were transporting rockets and ammunition, and normally there'd be somebody in front with a gun and somebody in the back with a gun, and the 10 or 15 people in the middle helping supplies didn't have any weapons. I mean, they were just...
Yeah.
They were mules, and that's all they were.
Did you ever run any Laos or Khmer forces?
Not that I know of.
Okay.
We didn't see a lot of dead people. They pretty much pulled my first tour. They pretty much, after any battle, they carried their wounded back off. They drug them off the battlefield almost exclusively. If you didn't kill 80 or 90% of the unit or all of them, then you didn't have any bodies on the ground. If it was a brief engagement with 20 or 30 people, then there usually wasn't anything there but blood trails.
Do you ever encounter any other enemy forces from any other country? If you don't want to say anything, that's fine.
Well, I've seen, I probably saw three or four dead Russian soldiers that were appeared to be acting as advisors. On my second tour, I saw probably a half a dozen over various reconnaissance and bomb damage assessment operations, probably four or five Chinese nationals that were in Chi-Com uniform. But not as a group. There was always just one here and one there. They were just about like our special forces advisors. There were one or two up here and there.
As far as equipment of your enemy, was it just completely hodgepodge, anything they could get their hands on, or was there any kind of standardization?
67 and 68, you'd see SKSs, a few AK-47s. Most of the stuff that they were carrying was stuff they'd taken from the
French
South Vietnamese Army. And
so M1 Grands?
Very few M1 Grands. They normally didn't carry those around because they were too big for them to carry. They normally carried M1 carbines. We'd pick up BARs occasionally. And you'd pick up a few AKs. Not a whole lot, but most of this just bolt-action rifles and a few semi-automatics. And there weren't a lot of AK-47s around until the NVA came down in the Tet Offensive of 68. And then there was a great proliferation of them because they brought apparently a lot of weaponry with them.
Yeah, they talked.
But those were regular troops, and they were geared different than the DC were.
Which enemy did you consider the most potentially lethal, like the better fighting force, the NVA or the...
Well, the Viet Cong seemed to be more dedicated to what they were doing, but they weren't an invading army, or at least claimed they weren't. They always shot from ambush and shot from behind something. It was a hit-and-run operation. And you never knew exactly who was shooting at you. You'd have women shooting at you, women throwing hand grenades at you. You'd have young children throwing hand grenades at you.
In those kind of situations, were y'all just forced to take care of the problem?
Well, you engage them as you see. We used to throw sea rations at the little kids if they had their hands behind their back, because they normally had a hand grenade in their hand. And you could normally throw a sea ration out there, and if they didn't pick it up, then you knew damn good and well you better get out of there.
Okay.
Or engage them. Because a normal child out there that was hungry, if you threw a can of sea rations at them or something like that, or a candy bar or something, they'd stop, pick it up. If they had a grenade behind their back, they wouldn't do it. And the women were the same way.
So this was with kids and women.
But you only saw that when you were just driving through the villages, not usually when you were approaching them. We didn't spend a lot of time inside villages.
These are very dangerous, kind of, weren't they?
Well, you never spent the night inside of a village. You only spent the night out in a clearing outside the area.
Old term DC on the night, huh? Okay, I think we've already kind of covered standard battle tactics that you used. What was the most effective weapon that y'all had in y'all's arsenal at your disposal at any given time? Flechette rounds?
Yeah, depending on where you were in. I don't know that the flechette rounds were that effective, but... If you were working in rice paddies, the M60 machine gun was probably as effective as anything. When you had an open lane of fire, if you were inside the jungle where the jungle wall was right next to your track, then a 12-gauge shotgun was probably the most effective round.
So y'all had shotguns too?
So each track had a shotgun on it.
What kind were they?
12-gauge pumps, Remingtons.
870s?
Probably. I don't know.
Was there a particular weapon that you wish you had that you didn't have during Vietnam?
No, the only weapons I had were the ones that I was issued.
Well, like if you could have had a different weapon
I had every weapon I wanted. I'd usually pick them up off the ground. If I wanted an AK, I usually had one on the track. Most of the enemy weapons that we picked up, before we turned them in, we shot all the ammunition out of them. Any ammunition that we captured, we shot back at them, or we used it for target practice, whether it was SKSs or AK-47s or the BARs or the M1 carbines. And we picked up a few M1s here and there, but we just shot them. We shot the ammo either back at them, or we just shot it as target practice. If you wanted to keep an AK-47 on the track, you could keep one on there. We had the capability of carrying it, unlike the infantry, which had to carry it around on their back. We didn't have to carry the stuff around. I usually kept an M14 on the track with a scope on it.
This is what you like.
But that's, you know, that was just happened to be my personal preference for a weapon.
Because you didn't have to carry ammo around either.
I didn't have to carry it anywhere. Yeah, we sat on top of the tracks and drove around, and unless we were out on an ambush patrol, all of our engagements were fought from the vehicles.
Okay.
In an armor engagement, the armored vehicle is a weapon in itself, whether it has any ammo on it or not, and you stay on the track, and that's what you offer. That's your base of operations right there.
Other than landmines and RPGs, wouldn't go through the APCs, would they?
Yep.
They would. So, what was the best way to not have that happen?
At night, we'd put chain link fence barriers up in front of us to catch them. RPGs are point detonating shape charges, and they'll penetrate about 18 inches of armor. A personnel carrier is about 3 inches thick, 2.5-3 inches thick of aluminum. So the RPG would certainly penetrate it at any point in time. It blows a hole in it about big enough to stick your finger in. And it blows all that hot molten aluminum or metal inside the track. And about half the time, there's enough magnesium content in that aluminum, it'd catch on fire. And it literally melt. It'd burn itself out. The metal would catch on fire. And I saw that happen 3 or 4 times.
The whole APC would
melt? Yeah, the APC would just burn up.
Because it had a lot of magnesium in it, kind of like a magnesium engine block.
Just like a magnesium flare.
Yeah. So they literally just self-consumed themselves.
But that usually happened when we carried white phosphorus grenades with us, smoke grenades, thermite grenades, because we used them to blow up bunkers. We threw the white phosphorus grenades in charcoal kilns because they used to hide in there.
Charcoal kilns?
They used to make charcoal over there. It's a big domed area that was 20 to 40 feet long. It had a clay roof over it, and they'd stack wood in there and set it on fire, and then they'd make charcoal. And it was charcoal wood. It wasn't compressed into briquettes like you get here, but it was just basically hardwood charcoal. And that's what they sold to the farmers and the villagers to cook over. And the heat, and that area over there during the rainy season is actually cold. Temperature's 50, 60 degrees, and it's wet, the wind's blowing, and so they had charcoal braziers and stuff like that inside their houses, and that's what they cooked on. But it was also a place for them to hide, for the VC would hide in there periodically. And the only way to keep from destroying it or blowing it up is you'd take a white phosphorus grenade and pitch it in there and set it off, and if there was anybody in there, they'd come out.
Or tear gas or something like that. Did y'all grab any tear gas?
Tear gas didn't seem to have much effect on people in bunkers.
So it was pretty useless.
And we used CS grenades, but you could throw them in a bunker, and that didn't guarantee somebody wasn't going to come out of there after the fact and shoot you. Mm-hmm. We usually threw either fragmentation grenades in there or white phosphorus, mostly frag grenades. And we also used demolition charges, what they call engineer charges.
So you didn't take any personal weapons with you?
I had a .357 sent to me when I was over there, but there wasn't any ammunition available for it. Only ammunition you get was .38 Special, and you could get a .38 Special there in the country. And when I left, I gave it to my replacement. He kept it. So.
I didn't even think about that.
You could have one sent to you usually in a care package, and a lot of people did, but you couldn't get it back in the States when you left. So most of them either stayed over there.
I see what it's saying. So when you couldn't...
Customs wouldn't let you bring them back in the country. They always searched everybody down when you came back in.
Yeah, a lot of people told me they said they'd put their pistols in the radios and stuff when they came back in.
It depends on where you came back in. When I flew back in through Fort Dix, New Jersey, they didn't search us at all. When we flew back in California, when we came back in there, that they strip searched everybody that came in.
Well, that's California.
So.
You were never shot down flying in a helicopter, were you? Were you ever almost shot down?
I had a lot of holes shot in helicopters. I just never had one shot out from under me.
Okay. Alright, were you wounded in Southeast Asia or Vietnam? When, how, and why? Well, we already know why. But when and how?
The first Purple Heart I received was from rescuing a track member. It was a member of my platoon that had been hit with an RPG. And he had fallen down through the main hatch and knocked himself out, and the track was on fire, and I went in there and pulled him out. And a fragmentation grenade and a white phosphorus grenade went off while I was in the track pulling him out.
Okay. And you
pretty much set us both on fire. When we came out, the other platoon members that were there poured water on us and put it out, and we went back into the base camp.
I thought you couldn't put white phosphorus out with water.
As long as it stays wet, it won't burn.
Okay.
It keeps the oxygen away from it.
Oh, you had to use peroxide
as soon as you use copper sulfate, what you use on
copper
it.
Sulfate. Oh, right.
Copper sulfate oxidizes the white phosphorus. But as long as you keep it wet and keep the oxygen off of it, which is what the water does, then it doesn't burn.
Did any of the three Purple Hearts that you received, three, right?
Yes.
Did any of them require long-term medical attention?
No.
So they're all kind of just scratches and...
Well,
burns,
not necessarily scratches. Knife hole.
Oh. You want to tell me about that or not?
I was on an ambush patrol, and we were looking for three or four guys in BC that were traveling through the area. And during that particular night, a group of 23 people came through that we engaged, and there were five of us on a patrol.
That y'all are engaging 23 enemies, and there are five of y'all?
Yeah.
Okay.
And that went down all right. I wound up getting into a fight with one individual with an SKS with a bayonet. And
hand-to-hand?
Hand-to-hand, and me with a machete, and he poked a hole in my side.
I could probably figure out the rest.
He didn't survive the engagement, but that's where the second Purple Heart came from. The third one came from an engagement when I was flying, and it was from shrapnel from a homemade Claymore mine that had flown over.
What? Oh, did they put Claymores in the trees so when y'all took off?
Well, that was what they call an improvised ship charge, and it was about the size of a garbage can lid. That we flew over, and it was embedded in the tree line, and they set it off when Robert was scouting the tree line up on the DMZ.
That's pretty damn sneaky. Alright, in your personal experience, how would you evaluate the leadership of the American, like, just American leadership in general in Vietnam? Because I know you're pretty... You're kind of in the middle.
It depended on who you were working for at the time. The squadron commander and the troop commanders I had in my first tour seemed to be well qualified, well trained, and dedicated.
How many of them do you know had previous combat experience? Do you know if any of them had?
I think most of the squadron commander had some Korean War experience, but the troop commanders were on their first combat tour just like I was. My second tour, when I was flying they were most of those guys were aviators, and they were on their second tour. But they seemed to be almost non-combatants in most cases because they wouldn't go out in the area of operations. The troop commander would.
In your experience, when y'all received casualties, because I know early in the war the medevacs kind of weren't too thrilled about going into hot zones. What was your experience?
No helicopter pilots thrilled about going into a hot zone.
Yeah. What was your experience with the medevacs? Were they reliable at all or not? Or
I don't know that I ever called a medevac or asked for one if there was one in the air that they didn't come in and land, or at least make the attempt.
So every time that you made a call, they'd at least try it?
They'd do it, or some other helicopter pilot would. Most of the helicopter pilots would. If one of them was just passing by and they got a call that there was an emergency, they would stop. If you could get them on the radio and talk to them, they'd stop and pick you up.
Because, okay.
I don't know that, and there probably were some instances when they didn't. But I did medevac work out of a scout helicopter.
The only reason I asked that question is, we'll talk about it later. Alright, this will seem a little bit weird question, but what do you remember most about combat? What's the thing that has stayed with you all these years? Or what did you learn? Do you think you came out of the experience with some greater understanding or something? Or
you come out with the understanding that you need to stay behind a rock, not behind a tree most of the time.
That's pretty good.
Most combat, actually, combat engagement are
controlled chaos.
They're quite scary. And if you can function through the fear and maintain your composure while you're doing it, then you're fine. 75-80% of the people that are actually engaged in there, the first two or three times they're in there, are in a blind panic. It's a scary situation to have someone shooting at you, knowing that they're not trying to do anything other than kill you. And you don't know who they are. You don't necessarily care who they are. But if you can maintain your composure and return fire, you can normally survive it. I don't know that there's any great epiphany that's involved in death experiences.
What was your hardest, I guess, obstacle of being a leader? What was the hardest part of the duty? I'm pretty sure I already know the answer, but
staying awake? Combat hours are long.
Keep in mind, this is as a commander.
Yeah. Well, just even as a commander, it's just if you're trying to engage the enemy in a guerrilla situation, your biggest challenge is actually trying to find them and engage them and keeping your people safe enough so they're not injured through accidents, so you've actually got them there when the engagement starts. We probably injured as many people in Vietnam by accident as they were actually injured by enemy fire.
So there was a fair amount of accidents, firearm discharges type things that went on?
Car wrecks. A lot of people get hurt just doing stuff.
Well, you have a bunch of young people.
Turn it off.
Did y'all ever do any civic actions, like build cities, or...
No, we didn't do that kind of stuff.
Y'all were strictly combat.
Cav units were pretty much strictly combat during that. We took out rice and stuff like that periodically for the villages or something, but we didn't build roads or schools or dig wells or do anything like that. We were strictly combat ops.
This is funny. Why do you think the U.S. was involved in Vietnam? If you can even begin to answer that.
Depends on whose conspiracy theory you're looking at.
Okay, well,
we were there to save the hearts and minds of the people, but that doesn't mean anything, and that doesn't mean what the grand strategy was. I don't know what it was. I was over there fighting because I wanted to be a soldier, and I wanted to go to war. And I was sent over there by my country to fight what was considered to be a just fight. And that's why I was there.
Okay. What did you think of the people in general that you're protecting, quote-unquote, the Vietnamese people in general? Do you feel that they respected that you were there and that they wanted your help, or did you feel that...
Once you got outside the cities, most of them were just rice farmers. They just wanted to be left alone to farm their rice. I don't know that they were particularly involved in it one way or the other. And that's usually what they were doing. I mean, they were out there farming rice with very archaic procedures, using water buffaloes and doing it all by hand. I don't know that I doubt that they even wanted us in there. They didn't really care one way or the other. They didn't want the VC coming in there, devastating their villages and raping the women and hauling the kids off and killing all the people in there, which they'd done on a number of barriers around there. They certainly didn't want that to happen either, but most of them appeared, and the ones that I talked to just wanted to go on about their lives as normal people and get the soldiers out of their business.
All right, just to clarify any misconceptions, were there ever any cases where any of your men acted, is quote-unquote, unsoldierly like?
No, not on my watch.
Okay. I wouldn't think so. When y'all had recreation time, what did that generally include?
Mostly sleeping. If we were on downtime or recreation time, people either went on in-country R&R, they either went to Bangkok or they went to Vung Tau. We stayed out in the jungle the whole time. When we came back into a base camp, it was to resupply and do maintenance.
A little drinking.
Drank at some of the enlisted clubs, but they didn't do a lot of that either. Take hot showers and, going about our business, but we always... And we were only in, a day to 2 days, and then we'd go right back out again. We didn't stay inside base camp perimeters. It's a matter of...
Y'all didn't have an actual base camp that y'all operated out of?
Yeah, right? But we were never there.
My actual
base camp was in Phu Loi, and I basically operated most of my operations north of Lai K, which was...
It's Phu Loi?
Phuloi. It's two words.
Okay, I gotcha. What were the living conditions like in the base camp? Just normal tent city type thing?
Canvas sea huts with plywood walls and canvas tops and wood floors in most of the years.
What's the most memorable experience you had inside of a base camp? Negative, positive, funny, not funny. Something that sticks with you today.
Probably the most memorable experience in a base camp was when a major jumped up on a bar and stuck his head in a ceiling fan and it scalped him because he was drunk. But that was just one of the few periods of time that we were back in at base camp.
I guess that would be the most humorous experience, probably.
Well, he was humorous, everybody else is. Humor is rather macabre in situations.
Alright, I tell you, when you were out in the field, you had normal sea rations and such. When y'all did get to base camps, did y'all get any better food, or... Or did...
depends on whose base camp you were. When you're out in the, when we were out in the field, if you're out there with an artillery unit, and sometimes most of the infantry units, if they they'd fly food into them, at least one hot meal a day, or tried to. If you were with an artillery unit, they always had a mess truck with them. And the food was just Army food. I mean, it's usually canned. It was, and a lot of it was canned roast
meat. So no steaks or anything like that?
Oh, you'd get steaks periodically, but not that often. Okay. It wasn't any, if... People back in the base camps ate a lot better than you did in the field.
Well, because by the time it got to you, they got all the good stuff. So.
It just depends on who's, you know, who's cooking it. I mean, if you had a bunch of sorry cooks working out there, then the food was miserable. Just as soon as you'd sit in your track and eat sea rations while they're serving hot food over there. So.
Did you ever correspond to anybody back home when you were there?
Well, I wrote to my wife all the time.
So you were married when you went over?
I was married when I was over there.
Do you ever encounter dangerous wildlife? Or do you have any stories about dangerous wildlife? Or
We used to shoot peacocks and roast them over a fire just for something to do.
Were they good?
They're kind of like wild turkey. They got a breast about an inch and a half, 2 inches wide. They're pretty good sized birds, but I mean, they were... You'd shoot them with shotguns. They had little deer over there that were about the size of a small dog called Dick Dick Deer, and we'd shoot those periodically. When they were cutting the jungle down, you'd normally wind up with a lot of wildlife that would be compressed in an area because they cut it in a racetrack formation. And we used to outpost it for the troop.
So y'all would literally take a section of jungle and slowly cut it
just
down?
Just cut it down to nothing, particularly along the roads and stuff. To push the jungle back out away from the roads where the convoys ran up and down. They cut it down with bulldozers. It had what they called Rome plow blades on them.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
And you'd get a bunch of engineer tanks out there, bulldozers out there, and they'd just cut the jungle down, push it back away from the road. And the way they did that is they'd cut it down in a circle, what we call a racetrack. And the lead tank would bust its way through the jungle to start the initial path, and then the bulldozers would come in and they'd cut it all the way down until it was gone. And when it got down to a certain point, all the wildlife would burst out of them because you usually had 6 to 8 bulldozers going around it in a circle.
I think you told me one instance about...
I told you about a tiger once when I was over there.
Yeah. Do you remember that?
Well, we'd set up a night defensive position at a cleared area. And we normally strung one strand of concertina around it just as a basic trip hazard. It didn't mean anything to anybody, really. And right at dusk, a tiger came to there and jumped over the concertina and walked through the base camp. And
like a big tiger?
Big full-grown tiger. Walked through one side of it and walked right back out the other. And there were people that were going to shoot it, and I told them just to hold the fire, to leave him alone. He just walked straight on through there. And then one of the air commanders I was working for at the time, who was an infantry brigade commander, had ordered us to secure that tiger for him, kill it, because he wanted the pelt. And we chased it for 3 days. But nobody ever shot the tiger.
Yeah, I never got it.
He never would get out of his helicopter to come shoot it, so nobody ever shot the tiger. But that's the only interesting one.
Seems kind of a waste of resources to chase a tiger for 3 days.
Well, we were on operations in the area anyway. I mean, we were. You could either hunt tigers or hunt monkeys or whatever you want to do rather than hunt people. It's a little better on your brain to think that you're actually out hunting or something.
Could you tell me about the instance that you were in the bar? What exactly, the circumstances were for that? If you not, you don't have to. That's fine.
Nah, I just didn't let that go.
Okay.
Da-da-da.
I just have a couple more questions, and we'll probably be done. Did you ever experience amongst your men any racial tension between them? Like, did you ever observe any?
Like, between the soldiers?
Yeah, like blacks and whites and Mexicans and...
There was some racial tension at some points, I don't know, none that was particularly unresolvable. Most of that occurred back in the base camps, but not particularly amongst your outlying combat troops.
So most of the squabbles went on during downtime and not during actual combat time.
There weren't any particular things that went on during combat that are worth mentioning. People are a little too busy to do that. Most of that's the racial tension stuff went on back in the base camps by people who were logistical support, rare area people who stayed back there all the time. And some of it was drug-induced, some of it was alcohol-induced.
Alright, towards our next question. What did you think about allegations that American soldiers used drugs in Vietnam and Southeast Asia?
Well, I don't know if they were allegations or not. They actually used, you know... My first tour, there wasn't a lot of prevalence of heroin. There was some marijuana and hashish that floated around there. It's easily detectable, though, when you're out in the jungle. And when I'm back in a base camp, when I'm back there, and I wasn't back there to see that. My second tour, there was quite a bit of heroin in use that was being sold up in I-Corps. They used to sell it in what they called $2 capsules, which were small vials about as big as the end of your finger. And on any given day, you could walk around the maintenance tents and pick up two handfuls of those capsules.
Just laying
on the ground. And they'd either snort it. Not a whole lot of them shot it, but it was pretty pure heroin. They mostly snorted it and smoked it.
It's from Vietnam.
And you could pretty well tell who was there. Most of the guys who were doing it, their nose was running all the time, and they usually kept a towel around their neck because they were going through withdrawal symptoms or whatever, and they were sweating a lot more than everybody else was, but they usually kept a wet towel around their neck.
Did drugs ever get in the way of combat at all? Did you ever catch any soldiers that were high or too drugged up to fight or drunk? On patrol, or too drunk to go on patrol?
I never had that much problem with patrol people. When you're out on patrol, there's just not a great access to that stuff, and you're not going to carry, you can't carry that much with you anyway. Whether there was some of it, there is, and there's probably some of it today. I mean, there was just a prevalence of drug use in the rear area personnel. More than it was the people who were actually out fighting under combat conditions. Most of your combat troops don't tolerate that very well. You don't want the guy that's supposed to be over there watching out for you nodding off. So if you know he's on drugs, you're going to turn him in.
So you're saying they kind of kept themselves in check.
Pretty much self-policed when you're doing that. If you're actually involved in combat operations, which is what I was most of the time I was there.
Would you like to tell me how you got the Silver Star and the 3 Brown Stars?
Well, I can tell you about the Silver Star if you want.
Okay.
I don't even know how to time that out.
Take your time.
One of the operations that we were involved in, this is when I was flying scout helicopters. We normally flew three teams, two active teams, an Alpha and a Bravo team, and then we had a standby team. I'd flown first light, which is at the crack of dawn on the Alpha team. And I went back to refuel, and the B team had just taken off, and we usually... If we were coming back in, the other team was outbound. We usually flew 45 to an hour and a half on site during actual flight time for reserves. And the B team was flying along the DMZ up along an area, what we called at that time the Camp Carroll line, and that was probably halfway through my second tour, and that aircraft was shot down. They ran across what they thought was an NVA company or a battalion, and they were shot down right on the demilitarized zone. And then when they decided that that was a green battalion, otherwise they wouldn't have shot at them. But they shot the scout bird down, and it crashed down in a valley, and the guys got out of that bird, left it there, and climbed to the top of a hill. And the lift bird that we always flew, a hunter killer team with an extraction team on board. And at that time, there was four aero riflemen, and they were unable to insert them because of the dead trees in the area where they had sprayed Agent Orange, and the dead trees were sticking up, so they couldn't get very close, and they couldn't repel them in, and there was so much ground fire that they shot the helicopter up so bad they had to come back in and land it. The Air Force sent a search and rescue bird in there to pick them up. And they shot it up so bad they had to pull off station. And they sent a second one in and they shot it up. Medevac couldn't get in because the ground fire was too hot. I had left after I'd refueled and flew back up there to watch. And they were having problems locating the guys. And I finally had located them. And the area was so tight that they couldn't get down close enough to them to actually pick them up because of those dead trees. So I took the crew that I had on board, which was two people, and I flew them over to one of the Arvin fire bases on that Camp Carroll line, dropped them off, emptied the helicopter, took all the ammo out of it, all the machine guns, kept a Car 15 and three magazines, even took the fire extinguisher out of it so it'd be empty. And I flew that empty bird back around by myself and then flew in and did a hot approach into it, circled back around and landed in that area and hovering straight down through about 35, 40 foot dead trees. Picked those three guys up out of a crater, got them on the aircraft, took probably 25 rounds in the bird when I did that, and then flew them back out of there. And when I got back, that's when they gave me a Silver Star for doing it. But that was it. It was a rescue mission to pull those people down there.
And you got three Bronze Stars?
I got three Bronze Stars. I got two on my first tour for rescue operations. When I got my first Purple Heart, I got a Bronze Star for pulling that guy out of that track.
What does the with V mean?
It's a valor device.
What's that?
The Bronze Star with V device, which means it's a heroic award, not a... At one time, the Bronze Star was strictly a valor award. It reached a point towards the latter stages of the war where they were giving them away for meritorious service. Because although the staff officers couldn't get awards, so they turned it into a higher award than an accommodation ribbon.
What did the 27 Air Medals, what were those about? Were those just campaign medals, or?
Air Medals started out when they used to fly combat missions in the Air Force and the Air Corps. And they gave them in Vietnam for, I think, every 25 or 50 combat hours that you actually flew. Rather than every five missions, you got an air medal if you were in the Air Force.
Oh,
we flew so many missions a day, they have to give you one every day. I used to fly four to five missions every day.
So that's why you had so many.
And they reached a point where they just kind of quit giving them to you. It's based on your amount of combat hours and how many hours you've flown in combat.
What did you do after Vietnam? In the Army? How long did you stay in after?
I went back in 72 and I was reassigned to the 101st Airborne. I was in the 101st Airborne attached to them when I left. And I redeployed back to the States with them. And I stayed there for 2 years in the cavalry, and I branch transferred back into the military police. And then I stayed in the military. I stayed in until another 5 years. And I got out in 1977.
What do you think about U.S. military interventions in other countries present?
Present?
Present.
There are times when we should go in and do that, and there's times when we should get out. The current involvement in Afghanistan, I think they've been there too long. They should have already left. Afghanistan has a history of eating the occupying armies. I don't know that they want to be liberated from themselves. The Iraqis, I can understand that. But here again, we may have stayed too long there also. I think there's something to be said for going in and doing your job and letting him take over and getting back out again. The public opinion of the press and the Democrats of the United States are really hazardous to your health when you're in the military. They always have been. You have people like John Kerry, who was a problem in Vietnam. And he's still a problem today. And I think if they'd ever released his military records, it would show that he doesn't belong where he's at and he should have never been running for president or anything else. So. And there were times when we should have went in. I think we should have went in into Somalia. We should have penetrated that area. We should have went into Zimbabwe when they were in any genocidal situation. I think we should actually intervene. Same thing happened in Germany. We should have intervened there way before, in World War II, before we did. A lot of people died, probably shouldn't have died.
Europe should have intervened.
Well, they should. I mean, it's...
They were ballers.
So. People stand sometimes and watch that, and you're going, you know, if there was an opportunity for you to act in a humanitarian manner, then this is it, whether it's with military operations or whatever. And they tend to ignore it, and they just don't do anything. And sometimes it's embarrassing. And it's embarrassing the way they treated the soldiers after Vietnam. The way I was treated was embarrassing.
How were you treated after Vietnam?
Oh, just like dirt.
You spit on?
I don't know that anybody ever spit on me. I don't know that you'd get that close to me. I'm not of the mind to let people do that, but I've had rocks thrown at me, and I've had people call me baby killer. And we were actually escorted out the back door, or the back gate of the airfield we landed in California, rather than going out the front gate because there were so many protesters. But that was strictly a media thing, and that was driven, again, by the Democratic Party.
What?
That's your Jane Fonda, Ted Kennedy people. And they're still here today.
What?
And they're going to do the same thing to the Iraqi veterans.
Do you think the freedom of press hurt the war effort in Vietnam or helped it?
I don't know. Seeing instantaneous coverage of death and mayhem is kind of tough for the average person. There's no mother that ever wants her son to die or her daughter to die, either one. But they're normally not, the people who are normally protesting are...
Don't know the time, by the way.
They're not involved, and that's just the way they are. And if they had an occupying army on their soil, they would be collaborators. Just like the French were. You know, they'll just roll over and die. There's always people who will stand for the country, and there's always those people who will stand in their way.
If you could do the whole thing over again, Vietnam, like, the whole thing, what would you have done differently? Would you have gone into the helicopter pilots first, or basically, the war experience to do over again, what, if anything, would you change?
I don't know, it's flying helicopters is worse to being on the ground. It's my first tour I was over there, there was not a lot of high-tech helicopter stuff over there. They were flying H-13s and A-model Hueys, if they even had them. They used H-13s out of the Korean War for scout ships. They were slow. They weren't armed.
H-13s were the plain-looking ones, right?
Those are the ones you see on MASH that are flying on MASH.
Are the ones that use the radial engines? They don't use a jet engine?
That wasn't a turbine. I think it was a flat six. I think it was a Lycoming four-cylinder or six-cylinder. I don't remember which. Some of that's been a long time ago. It's always best to be on the state-of-the-art side of things. It's kind of like it had been nice to have thermal imaging devices back in those days when we were fighting in the rain and around very dark perimeters in the jungle, but they didn't exist at that time. So the highest tech stuff we had on my first tour was a Starlight scope. And it was one of the original ones, and it was 2 feet long and 8-10 inches across. You know, it was a monster. So, and the stuff they use nowadays, you know, you fit on the top of a rifle. So, you use what you can, you know, you use whatever the equipment's available to you, and it doesn't make a whole lot of difference.
All right, this is a question, like, I'm sorry, but I have to ask it. what is your marital status now?
I'm married now.
Do you feel that service in Vietnam affected your marital status previously?
Well, yeah, it did. My first wife wanted me out of the house because I wasn't the same person that I was when she married me. And she said after my first tour, I was totally different. And after my second tour, she said I was not even close to being the same human being that I was before. I wasn't, quote, very attentive to her needs. My priorities had changed. Having a bottle of sour milk in a refrigerator wasn't particularly important to me anymore. And she just didn't like me anymore, and we wound up getting divorced. And I stayed single for 20 years before I got married again.
Did you have any religious beliefs before you went over to Vietnam, and did they change any after you came back?
No, I was a member of the Church of Christ when I went over there, and I'm still a member of the Church of Christ today. So.
Okay. How difficult was it to transition from being in the military life to going back to civilian life after you got back from Vietnam? Did you find it hard?
When I came back from Vietnam, I was still in the military. But there's an ingrained response time. It's in your brain and a reaction to certain stimulus, loud noises and things like that. That makes a combat soldier that's coming back into like an R&R or something like that, or just flying back into the States within 24 hours of being in combat. And there's no downtime and there's no time to depressurize. And all those combat responses or reactions are still with you.
Ingrained in your brain.
And it's a survival instinct that if you're actually in combat or even depending on what you were doing, if you were driving trucks or something like that, that you're looking for things on the road that don't exist. You're looking for landmines. You're looking for areas that have been disturbed on the side of the road. Loud noises are spooky. When I came back off my first tour, I came back right around the 4th of July, and strings of firecrackers were rather spooky. You react to them totally out of context from what they really are. Because your ears are telling you one thing, your brain's telling you duck, hide, run, cover, you know, pull your weapon out. You don't have a weapon, too. There's no place to get to cover. And everybody thinks you're nuts. I've seen guys come out of combat at a wedding and literally dive under tables from firecrackers. But they weren't shell-shocked or anything. It was just that their brain told them
danger.
Get to the ground and get under cover.
Their training was kicking in.
So it's hard to sleep with somebody like your wife or something when you get back, because different stimuli at night when you're asleep, if you're dreaming about something and somebody touches you, you react to it because you're not used to somebody touching you for a year. Well, at least you shouldn't be. So, other than someone shaking you to wake you up or something like that, and normally they'd do that, they'd hit you on the foot or something. They wouldn't get up close to your hands or your face to do that. But it takes you a while to decompress. It takes you, 15 to 20 days, sometimes 30 or 40 days, and sometimes people never decompress, but most people do after a period of time.
So you wouldn't say you suffer from any PTSD?
No.
Okay. Is there anything else you'd like to comment about your experience in Vietnam? Anything that you felt you learned or would like to pass on, or any kind of lesson?
No, I don't think so. I don't have any lessons to give.
Pretty much close to being done. So, when y'all were in combat operations and y'all were asked to assess body count, how did y'all do it?
When I was on the ground, we counted the bodies that were there.
So y'all didn't do the whole blood trail thing like some people did?
No.
Because I heard some units had their own saying, if there's a blood puddle this big, that means he died, or, you know, or whatever.
The body counts got inflated up higher up than where we were. If we counted a body, we were told that you had to have a body there. Now, if you had a pool of blood there as big as a man, you probably killed a guy, and they may count that when they drug them off, as I've said before. If you engaged 15 or 20 guys and you hit two or three of them, they wouldn't be there as a matter of routine. The bodies wouldn't be there. They'd drag them off. If you engaged them to the point and you had them surrounded where you could kill every one of them, then they'd all be there. You'd have 15 bodies there. As a matter of routine, and we usually had to airlift them out. Our body count was based on, they would take them back and dispose of them. We didn't leave them out in the field, even if there were napalm strikes or whatever. We were sent in to count bodies.
Wait, so y'all physically had to pick up the enemy?
We physically picked them up, put them in body bags, and brought them back in.
So y'all not only are dead, the enemy too?
We did them the same way we did ours. They were soldiers, and if they were killed in combat, we brought them back in. And all their paper, and we turned in military intelligence, took all their paperwork, all their identification, and they dealt with it from there. But we usually send them back out by helicopters. We'd take them out on the road and send in a Huey or something like that, or a Chinook, and we'd load them on there and then fly them back in. When I was doing what they call BDAs or bomb damage assessments, when I was flying, you counted bodies, what you could see. Or you counted bodies laying on the ground, because we didn't land and pick them up. They'd have an airstrike or a combat operation. We'd do a sweep around there and we'd count the bodies if we were doing a bomb damage assessment or looking for dead, wounded, or whatever. And then if the infantry went in after that, during my first part of the tour, we actually had combat ops going on out there. And that's the second part of that, my second tour, the last half of it. We'd pull back in, and the Arvins were doing all the infantry sweeps and stuff like that. We'd go out and do an assessment on an area and count the bodies, and if somebody else went back in it, it'd probably count them again. When they were
double counting,
it'd be a double count. But our information was you had to see the body on the ground, and frequently you'd go out there and you wouldn't see anything after a B-52 strike because there was so much debris out there.
Or they got vaporized.
And bodies don't really tend to vaporize.
Even if they
you'll see pieces of them, they'll be blown apart, but a human body's fairly resilient from a blast. I mean, at least there's pieces and parts laying around. And you count what you would see. Of course, there were some of them covered up, but a lot of times if it was a real close string, where they didn't get a good string effect on them, and they were pretty close together, there was so much debris, and everything was covered in dirt. All the trees that were blown down, everything's covered up in dirt. If they got penetration all the way to the ground. And you couldn't see a lot. And if you were getting shot at, you didn't stay very long either. So your assessment time on target when you flew out there might have been somewhere between 15 and 30 seconds usually on the flyby. If there was no hostile fire, you might linger out there for 4 or 5 minutes or something like that. But you didn't stay out there for an hour looking for bodies on the ground.
Did y'all have cameras on your helicopters
to
take pictures?
No. The only cameras we had at that time were big handheld aerial observation cameras. They were probably
so there wasn't any
10x10s. They were that big.
There wasn't any gun cameras, film type of stuff.
We didn't have any on our scout ships.
Okay. Did you ever? But you said you did occasionally fly an attack helicopter. Occasionally.
Yeah, I flew in those. I've flown in F-4s, trading rides with the Air Force. Flew in the OB-10s and the Bird Dogs and stuff like that, but we would just switch and rides out amongst pilots. They'd go out and fly with us.
I have one more question. When y'all were on the armored reconnaissance patrols at the very beginning of the war, and you said you'd go to base camps instead of base, and you were in I Corps, right?
No, I was in 3 Corps. When I
did. Oh, you were in 3 Corps when you did that.
I was down around Saigon North, basically.
So, okay, so y'all never ran to any Marines, really, too often? Like, if y'all stumbled onto a Marine camp, would y'all go in there and get supplies and everything from it, or was there...
There were Marines there, Marine observers, up on the forward fire bases on the DMZ. One of the Bronze Stars that I got was for rescuing one of the advisors off the top of a mountain that was being overrun. I flew in there and picked him up in a scout ship. And he hung onto the skids of the helicopter while I put him on the ground. And that was about a 3,000 or 4,000 foot drop off the side of a mountain.
That's scary.
He was scared. I mean, he was...
But he's been getting shot.
He was being overrun. They'd been hitting him all night long, and they were being overrun, and he was running down a trail, and he was screaming on the radio, somebody pick me up. And we were going out on a recon mission, and as we were flying by there, I saw him running, so I just swooped down there, and he just grabbed a skid, and I flew him off the side of the mountain. And he hit the ground down there just running.
So kept running.
Kept on going.
All right.
He got everybody drunk that night. After he got back to base, but he hit the ground running.